Krishna Productions presents the Ramayana, or the story of Lord Ram. It is a work of great antiquity, attributed to the illustrious sage Valmiki. Its date of composition cannot be fixed with any certainty, particularly as, in common with other Sanskrit classics, it was not at first committed to writing, but was passed on from singer to singer. Written in poetry of unsurpassed dramatic power and brilliance, the Ramayana contains 24,000 couplet verses or shlokas. Unfortunately, we know very little about the rishi or sage Valmiki. We do know that he was once a robber in a forest in northern India, and on one occasion waylaid two saints for the purpose of plundering them. The travelers, however, spoke to him with kindness and offered him spiritual truth instead of the gold and silver which they did not possess. Convinced of their sincerity and on their advice, Valmiki changed his way of life and became a devotee of Lord Ram, who was the seventh incarnation of God or Lord Vishnu on earth. Throughout the ages, the Ramayana has exerted a tremendous moral influence on men and women everywhere. Lord Ram is considered the ideal or supreme person, and in his daily life he manifested the highest degree of virtue, truth, compassion, justice, benevolence, valor, and chivalry, as we shall see. The following narration of the Ramayana is based on the abridged translation from the Sanskrit by Chakravarti Rajagopalachari and was published by Bharatiya Vidya Bhavan in Bombay, India. It contains all the important incidents of the original complete epic and was specially edited for this presentation by your narrator, Amala Bhaktadas. The story begins with the visit of Saint Narad one morning to the sage Valmiki's ashram. After the usual welcome, Valmiki asked him, "O all-knowing Narad, tell me, who among the heroes of this world is the highest in virtue and wisdom?" Knowing through his supernatural power why Valmiki put this question, Narad answered, "Lord Ram is the hero that you ask for. Born in the solar dynasty, he is at present ruling in Ayodhya." Sage Narad then briefly narrated to Valmiki the story of Ram. So impressed was Valmiki when he heard Ram's story that even long after Narad had left, his mind was pondering it as he went to the river Tamasa for his morning bath. As he was walking along the riverbank, he saw in a nearby tree two loving Krauncha birds sporting and singing in their joy of life and love. Suddenly, the male bird fell down, hit by a hunter's arrow. The female bird, seeing her lover rolling on the ground, lamented in piteous fashion. Observing this, Valmiki burst into a curse. "O hunter, as you have killed one of these love-intoxicated birds, you will wander homeless all your long years." But in a moment, the sage recovered himself and was wondering why he lost himself in anger. "What right had I to curse the hunter? Why was I deceived by emotion?" Recalling the words of his curse, the rishi marveled at the rhythm of the words. He discovered that his pity had taken shape in a beautiful verse. He thought that all this was part of the mysterious lila or play of God and went into meditation. To Valmiki in meditation appeared the four-faced Brahma and he said, "Be not afraid. These things happened to start you on the story of Ram. From sorrow sprang verse, and in this meter and rhythm, the story should be told. I shall give you the vision to see all that happened, yes, even how the characters thought and looked, as clearly as one sees a thing lying on the palm of one's hand. And you shall sing it with my blessings for the benefit of the world." Valmiki and his disciples then repeated the verse again and again and fixed its pattern firmly in their minds. Then Valmiki composed the Ramayana in that meter and taught it to his disciples. Thus was the holy Valmiki Ramayana born, the story of the Lord and his consort born on earth and establishing righteousness was sung by the sage in words of matchless beauty. And Brahma's words have come true, which were, "As long as the mountains stand, and the rivers flow, so long shall the Ramayana be cherished among men and save them from sin. To the north of the Ganges River was the great kingdom of Kosal, made fertile by the river Sarayu. Its capital was Ayodhya, built by Manu, the famous ruler of the Solar dynasty. King Dasarath ruled the kingdom from the capital city of Ayodhya. He had fought on the side of the demigods, and his fame spread in the three worlds. He was the equal of the demigods Indra, the king of the gods, and Kuvera, the god of wealth. The people of Kosal were happy, contented, and virtuous. The land was protected by a mighty army, and no enemy could come anywhere near. It contained forts with moats around them, as well as many defensive installations, and true to its name, Ayodhya defied all enemies. Dasarath had 8 wise ministers, ever ready to advise him and execute his orders. Great sages like Vasistha and Vamadeva and other Brahmins taught the religious codes and performed rituals and sacrifices. Taxes were light, and punishment of crime was just and inflicted according to the capacity of the wrongdoer. Surrounded by the best counselors and statesmen, the king's splendor shone as the rising sun. Many years rolled smoothly by. In the midst of all this prosperity, Dasarath had one regret. He had no son. One day in early summer, he thought of performing a horse sacrifice for progeny. He consulted his religious masters and, on their advice, got sage Rishyasringa to perform the jagya or sacrifice. The jagya was a grand affair, and the invitees included many of the kings of the day. It was no easy thing to perform sacrifices. The location and erection of the sacrificial platform had to be attended to in detail, strictly, according to prescribed rules. There were experts whose guidance was sought in arranging things. It meant the building of a new camp city, capable of accommodating tens of thousands and providing hospitality and entertainment for the invitees, who included the princes and sages of the land. When all the arrangements were complete, the ceremonies were set in motion strictly, as enjoined by the holy books. Contemporaneously with the jagya in Ayodhya, there was a conference of the demigods or devas in heaven. The devas complained to Lord Brahma that Ravan, king of the demons, drunk with the power acquired by the boon granted to him by Brahma, was causing them untold misery and hardship. They represented to Brahma, "It is beyond our capacity to subdue, conquer, or kill Ravan. In the security of your boon, he has grown wicked and insolent, and ill-treats all, even women. His desire is to dethrone Indra, the king of the gods. You are our only refuge, and it is for you to devise a method by which Ravan can be slain and his despotism ended." Brahma knew that he had granted to Ravan the boon prayed for by him, that he should be invulnerable and invincible against the demigods, demons, celestials, and other such beings. In his arrogance, Ravan did not care to ask for security against mankind. As Brahma revealed this fateful omission, all the demigods rejoiced and turned to Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Absolutely surrendering themselves to Vishnu, the devas begged him to be born as a man and to put an end to Ravan and his atrocities. Vishnu agreed and assured the devas that he would be born as 4 sons of King Dasarath, who was then performing a sacrifice for progeny. As the sacrifice was in progress, and as the ghee was poured into the ceremonial fire, the flames shot up to meet it. Then from out of the flames came a majestic figure, resplendent like the noonday sun, holding a golden bowl. Calling King Dasarath by his name, the figure said, "The demigods are pleased with you and are answering your prayer. Here is Payasam, sent by the gods for your wives. You will be blessed with sons if they drink this divine beverage." With joy unbounded, Dasarath received the bowl as he would receive a child, and distributed the payasam to his three wives, Kausalya, Sumitra, and Kaikeyi. He asked Kausalya to drink a half of the payasam, and he gave a half of what remained to Sumitra. Half of what was then left was drunk by Kaikeyi, and what remained was given to Sumitra again. Dasarath's wives were happy, as a beggar suddenly coming upon buried treasure, and in due course, all of them were expectant mothers. In course of time, Dasarath's sons were born, Ram of Kausalya and Bharat of Kaikeyi. Sumitra gave birth to twins, Lakshman and Shatrughan, she having drunk the divine payasam twice. Dasarath's four sons were given all the training prescribed for princes. Ram and Lakshman were specially devoted to each other, and so were Bharat and Shatrughan. Dasarath was happy to see his four sons grow up strong, virtuous, brave, and lovable, and with all other princely qualities. One day, as the king was contemplating his son's matrimony, ushers rushed in to announce that the great sage, Vishvamitra, had arrived to see him. Vishvamitra was held in awe by all as the most powerful among sages. Vishvamitra's arrival at Ayodhya was unexpected, and King Dasarath stepped down from his throne and advanced a few paces respectfully to receive the sage. Vishvamitra was a king who had attained sainthood through performing terrible austerities. King Dasarath received Vishvamitra, and touching his feet, the king said, "I am indeed blessed among men. Your coming can only be due to the merit of my ancestors. Like the morning sun that dispels the darkness of night, your face brings joy to my sight. My heart is full. Born a king, you have become through austerities a Brahma Rishi, or the highest of sages. And you yourself have come seeking my dwelling. Is there anything in my power that I can do for you? If so, command and I shall obey." Vishvamitra rejoiced to hear these words of Dasarath, and his face brightened. He said, "O king, your words are worthy of you. Born in the Ikshvaku line, with Vasistha for your guru, what else could you say? You have said yes before I asked. This fills my heart with joy." And he straightaway explained the purpose of his visit. "I am engaged in performing a sacrifice. As it nears completion, two powerful rakshasas, or demons, named Marich and Subahu, defile it. They shower unclean blood and flesh on the sacred fire. Like other sages, we could curse and destroy them, but that would be a waste of all of our spiritual merit. Our troubles will end if you send with me Ram, the eldest of your sons. Under my care, he will grow in princely stature. He will surely defeat these rakshasas, and his name will gather luster. Entrust Ram to my care only for a few days. Fulfill the promise you gave me unsought. Of Ram's safety, you need have no anxiety. You will earn undying fame in the three worlds. Vasistha and your ministers will agree with what I say." Dasarath trembled with fear and anxiety. He had a hard choice to make, either to give his well-beloved son to be killed by the Rakshasas, or himself incur the terrible anger of Vishvamitra. For a few moments, Dasarath stood speechless, for he was stunned and bewildered. But recovering from the shock, he begged the sage not to press his demand and said, "Ram is not yet fully 16 years of age. How can he fight with Rakshasas? Of what use is it to send him with you? What does he know of the wiles of Rakshasas? It is not right that I should send a mere lad to fight them. I am here and my army is ready to march. How can a lad protect you and your sacrifice? Tell me all about your enemies, and I shall go with you at the head of my army and do your bidding and serve your need. Do tell me about these desecrators." Vishvamitra described Marich and Subahu and Ravan, their master, and he demanded again that Ram should be sent along with him. Dasarath persisted in refusal. "Parting from Ram will be death to me. I shall go with you, I and my army. Why, it seems to me the task proposed is pretty hard even for me. How then can I send my son to cope with it? Indeed, I cannot send him. If you please, I am ready with my army. Dasarath's attempt to go back on his hasty word enraged Vishvamitra. The king's pleas and reasons were like oil poured on fire of his anger. So the sage said, "This conduct is unworthy of your lineage. Tell me if this is your final word. I shall go back the way I came. Long may you live with your kith and kin, having swerved from the path of truth." The earth quaked, and the gods were afraid of the possible consequences of the sage's wrath. Vasistha now turned to the king and spoke gently. "It ill becomes you, king, to refuse, having promised once. Born in the Ikshvaku family, you cannot do it. Having once said, 'I will do,' you have no option but to do it. Failing, you will lose the merit of all your great gifts and deeds. Send Ram with the sage, and send Lakshman too. You need have no fear for their safety. When they are protected by Vishvamitra, no Rakshasa can hurt them. You have no idea of Vishvamitra's power. He is penance in human form. Bravest of the brave and wisest of the wise, he is master of every weapon. In the three worlds, there is not, and there will never be, any to equal him in martial or spiritual prowess. When he was king, he obtained from the gods mastery of all weapons. He beholds the past, the present, and the future. Then why does he want the princes, you may wonder? He can well take care himself of his sacrifice. But it is for the good of your sons that he has come here and appears to seek your help. Do not hesitate. Send your sons with him." Listening to the wise Vasistha, Dasarath saw things clearly and made up his mind to send Ram and Lakshman. The two princes were then brought to the presence of the sage. The king, the queen mothers, and Vasistha blessed them and sent them with Vishvamitra. A pleasant breeze wafted, and flowers were strewn by the denizens of the heavens. Auspicious sounds were heard. Bow in hand, the two lads strode proudly on either side of the sage. With swords of victory hanging from their waists, bows and quivers mounted on strong shoulders, they moved, each like a three-headed cobra with uplifted hood. Vishvamitra and the two princes spent the night on the bank of the river Sarayu. Before retiring, Vishvamitra initiated the princes in two secret mantras or invocations, Bala and Atibala, which had the virtue of guarding them from fatigue and harm. They slept on the verdant bank that night, and rising at dawn, proceeded on their journey. They reached Kama Ashram in Anga Desh. After presenting the princes to the sages there, Vishvamitra recounted to them the history of the ashram. "This," he said, "is the place where Lord Shiva was long engaged in austerities. It was here that the foolish god of love, Kama, aimed his arrow at Shiva and was turned to ashes by his wrath. Hence the place is known as Kama Ashram." They were guests of the rishis or sages that night, and the following morning, after performing the usual rites, the sage and his pupils set out on their journey and reached the Ganges. They crossed the river on a raft got ready for them by the rishis. In midstream, the princes heard a noise and asked Vishvamitra what it could be. He explained to them that it was the sound of the Sarayu flowing into the Ganges. The princes paid silent homage to the confluence of the two holy rivers. Having crossed the Ganges, Vishvamitra and the princes made their difficult way through a dense forest made dreadful by the reverberating roar of wild beasts. "This," Vishvamitra said, "is the Dandak forest. What is now a terrible forest was once a well-peopled country. Once upon a time, Indra, the king of the gods, was contaminated by sin, having killed Vritra, and had therefore to exile himself from the world of the devas or demigods. The devas set to themselves the task of cleansing Indra. They brought waters from the sacred rivers and bathed him to the accompaniment of mantras. The waters which cleansed Indra flowed into the ground and enriched the earth, and the land became tremendously fertile. For a long time, people lived happily till Tataka and her son Marich wrought havoc and changed this into the dreadful wilderness it now is. They are still in this forest, and none dare enter it for fear of Tataka. She is equal in strength to a score of elephants. I have brought you here to rid the forest of this great enemy. There is no doubt that this Yaksha monster, who is a source of trouble to the sages, will be destroyed by you. Ram, who listened to this, asked the sage, "You say she is a Yaksha, that low form of celestial beings. I have never heard that Yakshas are particularly strong. What is more, how does a woman happen to possess so much strength?" Vishvamitra replied, "You are asking a very pertinent question. Her strength comes from a boon granted by Brahma. There lived a Yaksha by name Suketu. Having no progeny, he performed austerities and won a boon from Brahma thus. You will have a beautiful daughter of great strength of body, but you will have no son. Suketu's daughter, Tataka, beautiful and strong, was married to Sunda, a Yaksha, and their child is Marich. Sunda at one time incurred sage Agastya's curse and died. Provoked by this, Tataka and Marich pounced on Agastya, who cursed them to be monsters living on the carcasses of men. So Tataka is now an ugly monster. Thenceforward, she and Marich have been harassing the dwellers in this region of Agastya. Do not hesitate to destroy her on the ground that it is against warrior ethics to kill a woman. Her atrocities are intolerable. To punish the wicked, whether male or female, is the duty of kings. It is right to kill her as to kill a wild animal for the sake of human society. This is the duty cast on rulers. Many women have been punished with death for their crimes. Hence, do not hesitate." Ram said to Vishvamitra, "Our father's behest is that we should obey you without question. Bidden by you and for the general welfare, we shall kill Tataka." So saying, he strung his bow and twanged it, till the forest echoed to its shrill note, and the wild animals scattered in all directions in terror. It reached Tataka in her stronghold, filling her with amazement at the audacious intruder who dared enter her domain. Raging with anger, she ran in the direction whence the sound came and sprang on Ram. The battle began. The prince at first thought of cutting off the limbs of the monster and sparing her life. But Tataka attacked fiercely, and rising in the sky, she rained stones on Ram and Lakshman. The two princes defended themselves against the attack. The fight continued, and Vishvamitra cautioned Ram against delay in dealing the death blow to the monster. "She deserves no sympathy," he said. "The sun is about to set, and remember that at night, Rakshasas grow stronger. Do not delay to slay her." Thus advised, Ram decided on killing Tataka, and pierced her chest with a deadly arrow, and the huge, ugly monster fell down lifeless. The devas cheered, and Vishvamitra, filled with joy, embraced Ram and blessed him. With Tataka's end, the forest was freed from the curse and became beautiful to see. The princes spent the night there, and next morning they proceeded to Vishvamitra's ashram. At dawn the next day, Vishvamitra called Ram to his side, and blessing him said, "I am very happy indeed. What is it that I can do in return for all that you have done? I shall teach you the use of all the astras or divine weapons." So saying, Vishvamitra gave Ramchandra the divine astras, which he had obtained through his austerities. Vishvamitra taught Ram the use, control, and recall of the various divine weapons, and Ram, in his turn, imparted the knowledge to Lakshman. As they continued the journey, Ram pointed to a big hill with a lovely forest on its slopes and asked, "Is that the place whereto we have to go? And who are the evil ones who hinder your yajna? And what should I do to destroy them?" Ramchandra was eager to fight and win the blessings of the sage. "That is the place we are going to," replied Vishvamitra. There the Lord Narayan performed austerities, and it was there that he was born as Vaman. It goes by the name of Siddha Ashram. This is its story. Bali, son of Virochan, and grandson of Prahlad, the great devotee, was such a powerful ruler that of him even the devas were afraid. Bali had, by his deeds, acquired the power of Indra himself. He belonged to the race of the asuras or demons. Kashyap and his spouse Aditi, of whom all the gods were offsprings, prayed to Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and begged him to be born as their son and protect Indra and the devas from Bali. In answer to their prayers, Vishnu was born of Aditi as Vaman. Vaman, in the form of a young student, went to the sacrifice that was being performed by Bali, and where all were welcome to ask for and receive anything they wanted. When Vaman presented himself as a suitor, Bali's guru, Sukracharya, the preceptor of all the asuras or demons, knew who he really was. So he warned Bali against promising to grant the young Brahmin his request, that indeed he was Lord Vishnu in disguise, come to undo him. Bali did not pay heed to this. It was his practice never to turn down a request. Besides, he was at heart a devotee of the Lord, and felt that he would indeed be blessed if the Lord should deign to accept a gift from him. With a smile, Bali bade him ask for what he pleased, without hesitation. "All I have is at your disposal, money, jewels, the wide earth, and all it inherits." Vaman answered that the wealth was of no use to him, and all he begged for was 3 paces of ground, as paced by him. The monarch smiled as he looked at the diminutive student's legs and said, "So be it. Pace and take it." The little Brahmin suddenly grew in size, and with one step measured the earth, and with another the entire heavens. And there being no room left for the third step that had been granted, he set his foot on Bali's devoted head. And Bali, whose head was blessed by the touch of Brahmin's foot, became one of the 7 immortals of the world. After narrating the story of Bali, Vishvamitra added, "This is where at first Narayan and later Kashyap performed tapas or austerity, resulting in the incarnation of God as Vaman. In this holy place I live, and here the Rakshasas come and obstruct our worship and our austerities. Your coming here is to end this evil." "So be it," said Ram. The arrival of Vishvamitra and the 2 princes was a signal for rejoicing at the ashram. The rishis offered water and fruits according to custom. Ram told Vishvamitra that he could begin the preparations for his yajna immediately, and Vishvamitra took the vows that very night. Getting up very early the next morning, the princes went to Vishvamitra and asked when the Rakshasas were expected, so that they might hold themselves in readiness to receive them. Vishvamitra was under a vow of silence and could not answer. But the rishis, his juniors, told the princes that they should be constantly vigilant for 6 nights and days to safeguard the sacrifice. The princes, fully armed, kept vigil for 6 days and nights. On the morning of the 6th day, Ram told Lakshman, "Brother, now is the time for the enemies to come. Let us be wary." Even as he was saying this, flames shot up from the sacrificial fire, for Agni, the god of fire, knew that the Rakshasas had arrived. As the rites were being performed, there was heard from the sky a great roar. Ram looked up and saw Marich, Subahu, and their followers preparing to shower unclean things on the sacrificial fire. The army of Rakshasas covered the sky like a great black cloud. Ram said, "Look, Lakshman!" And he shot an arrow, the Manavastra weapon, at Marich. As was intended, it did not kill Marich, but wrapping him up in resistless force, hurled him a full 900 miles near the sea. With the Agnyastra, or fire weapon, Ram killed Subahu, and then the two princes utterly destroyed the entire army of Rakshasas. The sky was bright again. Vishvamitra was supremely happy at the completion of his sacrifice. "I am grateful to King Dasarath," he said. "You have fulfilled the promise, princes. I admire your fortitude. This ashram has, through you, become again a scene of success." The next day, Ram and Lakshman, after their morning prayers, went to Vishvamitra and asked for further orders. The purpose of Ram's birth was not unknown to sage Vishvamitra, and he knew too the powers of the weapons he had given to Ram. Still, the actual fact when experienced is something more than expectation. Sage Vishvamitra was happy beyond words, and his face glowed like a flame. He then thought of the service that he still had to do for Ram. This was the prince's marriage with Sita. The seers assembled there said to Ram, "We intend proceeding to the kingdom of Vidheya, where in the capital city of Mithila, the illustrious philosopher king, Janak, intends to perform a great sacrifice. All of us are going there, and it will be good if you and your brother accompany us. It is fitting and proper that the prince of Ayodhya should see the marvelous bow in the court of Janak." So it was decided, and Ram and Lakshman went with Vishvamitra to Janak city. Janak, king of Mithila, was an ideal ruler. He was a much revered friend of King Dasarath, who, when he planned his yajna for progeny, sent not mere messengers, but ministers to Mithila to invite King Janak. Janak was not only a brave king, but was as well versed in the scriptures as any rishi, and was the beloved pupil of sage Yajnavalkya. Desirous of performing a sacrifice, Janak at one time plowed the chosen site. As usual, this was done by his own hand. As the field was being cleared and leveled, Janak saw within the soil a baby, divinely beautiful. Janak was childless, so he accepted the infant as the goddess Earth's gift to him. Taking the child in his arms, he went to his beloved wife and said, "Here is treasure for us. I found this child on the yajna site, and we shall make it our own." And she joyfully consented. The child was an incarnation of the goddess of prosperity, Lakshmi, and she was named Sita. When Sita reached the age of marriage, Janak was sad that he would have to part with her. Though he tried hard, he was for long unable to choose a prince worthy of Sita. Many kings came to Mithila, seeking Sita's hand, but in Janak's view, none of them was good enough. The king anxiously thought over the matter and came to a decision. Long ago, pleased with a sacrifice performed by Janak, Varun, the ocean demigod, presented to him Lord Shiva's bow and two quivers. That was an ancient heavenly bow, which no ordinary man could even move. This was kept by him as an honored heirloom. Since only a very exceptional man could be considered worthy of Sita, Janak issued this proclamation. "Sita, my daughter, will be given in marriage to the prince who can lift, bend, and string the bow of Lord Shiva." Many princes who had heard of Sita's beauty went to Mithila, only to return disappointed, for none could fulfill the condition. Led by Vishvamitra, the rishis from Siddha Ashram were proceeding to Mithila with bullock carts transporting their luggage. The animals and the birds in the ashram set out to follow Vishvamitra, but he gently bade them stay behind. It was evening when they reached the river Son. There they rested for the night, Vishvamitra recounting to Ram and Lakshman the history of the place. Getting up in the morning, they continued their journey and crossed another river, not very deep, and by noon they were at the Ganges. They bathed in the holy river, and the rishis made offerings to their forebears. They improvised an ashram there, performed their worship, cooked their food. After their meal, they sat round Vishvamitra, who, at the request of the two princes, told the story of the Ganges, which was as follows. Himavan, king of mountains, and his spouse, Manorama, had two daughters, of whom Ganga was the elder. Himavan sent her to the world of the demigods in response to their request, and so she dwelt with them. Uma, the younger, won the favor of Lord Shiva and became his spouse. Sagara, a former king of Ayodhya, had no son for a long time. With his two wives, Keshini and Sumati, he went to the Himalaya mountains and performed penances. Sage Bhrigu, pleased with the king, blessed him and said, "You will get a number of children and will acquire undying fame. One of your wives will give birth to an only son, and through him your lineage will be continued. The other queen will bear 60,000 strong-armed sons." Sagara's wives bowed low before the sage and asked which one of them would get an only son and which the 60,000. Sage Bhrigu asked each of them their own desire. Keshini said she would be satisfied with one son, who would continue the line. Sumati chose the other alternative. "Be it so," said the sage. Satisfied, the king and his wives took leave of the sage and returned to Ayodhya. In course of time, Asamanjas was born to Keshini. Sumati gave birth to a mass which divided into 60,000 babies. This army of children was well taken care of by the nurses. The years rolled by, and while the 60,000 grew into strong, handsome princes, Asamanjas turned out to be a cruel lunatic. He indulged in the pastime of throwing little children into the river and laughed merrily as they struggled and died. Naturally, people hated this maniac and banished him from the country. To the great relief of all, Asamanja's son, Ansuman, was just the opposite of his father and was a brave, virtuous, and amiable prince. King Sagara launched a great horse sacrifice, and Prince Ansuman was in charge of the sacrificial horse. But Indra, in the guise of a Rakshasa, managed to steal the animal. The demigods regarded Jagyas by mortals as a challenge to their superiority and lost no opportunity of throwing obstacles in their way. If, however, all obstruction was overcome and the sacrifice was completed, they accepted the offerings made to them. And then he who performed the Jagya got due reward. The king was greatly upset when he heard that the sacrificial horse had been stolen. He sent out the 60,000 sons of Sumati to go in search of the animal all over the earth and to spare no pains to retrieve it. The loss of the horse, he impressed on them, not only means obstruction to the Jagya, it casts sin and dishonor on all concerned. You should therefore recover the horse wherever it may be hidden. Eagerly, the sons of Sagara proceeded to search the entire earth, but the horse was nowhere to be found. They even started digging the earth as for buried treasure, and in their anxiety respected neither place nor person, and only succeeded in earning the hatred of all whom they met. The horse was not to be found, and when they reported their failure to the king, he bade them ransack the netherworld also. The princes did as they were told, and in the netherworld, or Patala, they saw the horse grazing in a corner of an ashram, not far from the place where sage Kapil, who was an incarnation of Lord Vishnu, sat in meditation. The princes at once jumped to the conclusion that they had not only found the stolen horse, but the thief also, and they rushed on Kapil shouting, "Here is the thief pretending to be a yogi!" Kapil, thus disturbed, opened his fiery eyes, and the 60,000 princes were reduced to a heap of ashes. Indra, king of the gods, the real thief, had artfully left the horse here with this very intent. King Sagara waited in vain for the return of the princes, who had gone in search of the sacrificial horse. After some days, he called his grandson, Amsuman, and said, "I am anxious to know what has happened to the princes who went to Patala. You are brave, so go there well armed and find out what has happened, and come back crowned with success." Amsuman went closely following the path of the princes, and reached the netherworld, where he saw and paid salutations to the mighty elephants standing guard at the four quarters. These guardians of the quarters uttered encouraging words and said he would succeed in his mission. When in due course Amsuman entered and went round Patala, he was delighted when he found the sacrificial horse grazing contentedly there, but was perplexed and distressed when he saw heaps of ashes all over the place. Could they be all that remained of his valiant uncles? Garuda, the bird king, carrier of Lord Vishnu and brother of Sumati, Sagara's second wife, who chanced to be there, told Amsuman, "Those ash heaps are all that is left of the 60,000 sons of Sagara, who are consumed by the wrathful glance of sage Kapil. Dear child, take the horse and complete the yajna. If these ashes are to be watered according to custom, so that the souls of the princes may rest in peace, Ganga should be brought down here from the heavenly world of the demigods." Amsuman rushed home with the horse and told the king all that he had found and learned. Sagara was immersed in sorrow at the fate that had overtaken his sons. However, the horse, having been brought back, he completed the sacrifice. Grieving over his lost sons and despairing of ever bringing Ganga down to the netherworld, he died disconsolate.